All right. Hi, my name is Diana Limbach-Lempel, and I am speaking with Jennifer Weiland-Strodel for the Education Narratives Phase 7 of our interview project with educators during the time of COVID-19. Jennifer, where are you beaming into us from today?
I'm in Ghent, New York.
And I am in Sunderland, Massachusetts, in my bedroom. Jennifer, I would love to just start. Well, first of all, I just want to thank you for being a part of this project. This is my second of the final phase interviews that I've done, and just the feeling of speaking with someone for so long and being able to look back together was really beautiful. And I'm looking forward to doing the same with you today, and just want to acknowledge the time and the care that you've given to this project over the past 2 years, in a time that has been very intense for you and for all of us. So today what we'll do is we'll catch up on you, and we'll talk about where you're at right now, and we'll also do a little looking back and reflecting on the Education Narratives Project as a whole. Mm-hmm. And I'll make sure that we stop around 12:45 to hear anything else that doesn't come out naturally from us in the conversation, so you really get the chance to put on the record what you want to. So catch us up. Where are you at right now?
Okay. Well, where I'm at right now is that I am living, I have not moved my place of residence. I'm living in my home with my family. So my personal life has not gone through major transitions or changes, but definitely my life in education has during COVID. So right now, currently, I am working for Bard College in the communications office. And so I am not directly teaching or in the role of educator, but I am still working in education and higher education now. And it's great. I love Bard College, and I love my colleagues there. So that's good, and I'm working largely from home. I do go to Bard campus about once or twice a week, but mostly it's from home. And I'm also working as a curriculum consultant, I kind of make up my own title. So I call myself either curriculum consultant or curriculum designer, but basically I'm working very closely with another founder and visionary, on the 10th Academy, which is just at the very beginning, like the birth stages. And it's, very exciting. And that, that is also a higher education institution for Black and Brown, trans and queer youth. But just like any creative project, it's very in the moment and flexible. And so as we've launched the program, we realized just due to funding and the bandwidth of the people involved, we can't, just launch in the full manifestation of the vision. So right now we're offering multi-age programs for people who are 18 to 24 is our target student body, but we're also offering it to adults of all ages and kind of creating these wonderful intergenerational, multi-generational classes. The mission and vision of the project is to offer all this education free, completely free, all expenses paid for our youth student body. But like right now we're offering paid programs for the adults. And so it's based in Hudson, but it's also, we also offer virtual programs to reach people from all over the country. And the founder, Kyrie, also travels a lot. So he's got community in New Orleans and LA and New York City. And so it's just an exciting, the beginnings of a very exciting educational initiative.
Wow. So, yeah. So that is a big change from what you were doing at the beginning of these interviews, at the beginning of the Education Narratives Project in 2020. Tell me about, we've heard your journey over over the interviews. So I don't need you to recap all of the details, but I'm interested at the place you're at now to hear you reflect a little bit about working with older students, working, navigating how you're feeling about hybrid now after experimenting in different ways of using technology in the classroom. Tell me about that.
Yeah, definitely. I think that for me, my interest in education really is with the kind of creative curriculum and really I'm trying to break out of these conventional and potentially repressive ways of teaching children and people. So with the changing age group, it's a little older than where I was coming from. And I really miss working with children. And I know that my journey will bring me back to the younger age group, but it's all in the same line of thinking, approaches, and sort of vision, which is to really kind of free and liberate the mind to think so that people can think for themselves and really kind of develop their own ideas and voice around their own thinking. And as a result, my hope is to really develop their full being and agency in the world on their terms. And I do believe that education is a very important piece of that puzzle for people. I do think that the challenge and the asking the right questions and stretching yourself and being in a environment where there are educators or programs that are asking you to actually go out of your comfort zone and stretch your mind and, read more of this literature and do that and do these activities. So that's why for me, it's like education plays a very important role. So it is a big shift, working with older in higher education, but I think that when I started the Libri School, there was a part of the seed of the Libri School in which, for me personally, I found that when I got to a higher education environment, when I got to college, was when I was finally like allowed to speak my mind freely and actually explore my ideas. And people were asking me what I thought. And it was a feeling of, oh, you've graduated high school. You're finally at the age. You're finally at the intellectual development that we can ask you these things, and you can write a paper, and you can choose a topic, and all of these things. And for me, in my experience in childhood, I was like there from day one. I had ideas from day one, and I had opinions, and I could think very clearly about issues, and I was very curious. So it really kind of, I was like, finally in college. And at the same time, I was like, why did I have to wait so long? And so that was very much the genesis of the Libri School model, where I really was thinking like bringing those liberal arts education values right down to the kindergarten level to day one and really allowing students to develop that kind of thinking. And that was very much part of the model of the Libri School. So in a lot of ways, working now in higher education is a continuation of that journey. It's not such a huge shift in terms of philosophy or approach. And then also the other thing with this project I'm working with 10A and why I was really attracted to the initiative and working with Kyrie is because I really do believe that there was this moment during the pandemic where everybody was questioning education and the way things have settled is a little different than I had expected. But there was just this huge opportunity where I really thought like, oh, this is the opportunity just to dismantle the status quo, to really kind of like question the conventional approaches to education in a large scale way. And the sort of access to higher education and the all the institutions around higher education, I thought were really also ripe for questioning. So this project that I'm working on really, in my mind, really takes on a new radical approach, which is just to offer it free to students. And it's not, right now, it's not trying to form itself as like a conventional degree, granting institution. It's more just really about education and providing programs that are really expanding people's horizons and minds and giving them access to great ideas and skills and all of that And I think that that's the point of education. And a lot of times universities seem to be doing something else, making money off of it. And I know just it's a bit kind of like in the box. It's sort of, and so this was exciting in that sense, as well as the fact that it is created by and for people of color, queer and trans people. I just think that that's another big important thing that has to happen in education, where it's like, we don't really want to just continue as people of color, as, you know, as people who have different ways of thinking. We don't want to just always have to like kind of find our way and find our way within these systems that have been built on completely different values and are trying to empower and rise up, you know, just the same people. And so you can kind of like get with the program and rise up in that system and succeed within that system, but it's not really necessarily speaking to your true self or your whole self and your whole identity. Or you can reject it, or you can find, like, you know, carve out a little niche and alternative and sort of toe both lines. It just seems to me like a very exciting idea to start creating institutions that are just not coming from the baseline of like, let me fit myself into this very masculine, hetero, patriarchal, Western, you know, white belief system, but to just sort of say, like, let's just start from our own experiences, from our cultural viewpoints, and go from there. And so that's also exciting to me. And I think so in a lot of ways, it's a very different project, but very also much in alignment with the values and the direction and the impact that I would want to make on education, which is just sort of really challenging the status quo and trying to create alternative and creative and joyful ways of learning and educating students that actually kind of go foundationally and fundamentally start from a different assumption or start from a different place. And I think that's important. Like, for example, one thing that with 10A just that I love is that it is built by and for people of color, queer and trans learners. It's not like you take an institution that has no space for that and then you realize, oh, this isn't right, we have to be inclusive, and then you try and bring people into that institution, but the institution itself is systemically problematic, and it just alienates and further isolates those students that you're recruiting or even faculty. And so, like, I'm always like pushing for bringing in faculty of color and administrators of color so that it's not just, you know, bringing in students without that support, but it's still problematic. Like, it's just difficult. So yeah, I'm hoping for, I guess I'm still pushing for alternative models in education, like just really saying, like, let's try lots of different stuff and let's let lots of things exist at the same time and have partnerships and mutual support and everything. But then in terms of technology, virtual and in person, I think that right now 10A is very working off of a hybrid model. So we've put a lot of energy into creating virtual experiences that are very immersive, and so that it doesn't feel like you're just logging onto a Zoom and you're doing a regular Zoom class, but it's sort of, we try and do camera work that's cinematic on the professor who's talking, and, you know, like a lot of attention is brought to that, so that if you're logging on virtually, you're still getting a sensory and immersive experience. And then we do, you know, we're trying to set up the classroom so that it's hybrid. So there are some in-person students, and then there'll be some students who are logging on, and we kind of set up the camera and the Zoom so that the Zoom room has like a screen sort of in the classroom so that people can interact with each other. So hybrid virtual students and in-person students can interact, and they can all, you know, be part of the discussion simultaneously. So I think that, I guess, like, moving forward, what I kind of realized is that this virtual way of teaching and learning has been introduced on large scale, and it's very accessible and familiar to everyone now. And I don't think it should be thrown away now that we can have in-person classes. And so I'm still like a big supporter of it. I acknowledge though, it isn't the same, so that there is a different, you have a different experience when you're actually in person with your classmates and your teacher, and that can't replace. And I think that for me too, when I was running the Libre School 100% virtually, there was an element of not having that in-person component that I really missed. So I think other people, like, I'm fully in support of schools that are, you know, offering virtual classes 100% virtual. It meets a different need. But for me personally, it wasn't something I could see really investing in forever. I realized I really missed in-person component. That's me personally. But I do think that the technology is great. I think it's great. I think it's there. It's great. I think it has opened up doors to accessibility. It's not the same though. It's definitely not the same. And so I think that, you know, there are certain classes that you only want to do in person, and there's opportunities that really are so much richer in person. And I'm so glad that we get to do that now. Like, I'm so glad we are not still all isolated and not meeting in person. So, yeah.
I want to acknowledge that I hear that alignment that you were talking about. And that must be a really satisfying feeling to have that alignment. And I want to ask what you feel like is missing when you're all virtual, or what was missing for you, I guess, is the question that I have. What is missing for you when it's all virtual?
I mean, I think especially with children, a lot was missing, but with adults, you still want to, like, I find like teaching and interacting with older students, say like 18 and older, or even, you know, even teenagers, I think it's just like, there's a certain kind of, physical, I think it's actually somatic. I think it's actually like a physical energy that is exchanged, the way your body reacts in the presence of other people, the way you connect and the way your heartbeat rises. If someone says something really exciting, if you feel embarrassed, if you're going to be very vulnerable, and all of that energy is being exchanged in the room. And so I do think it's a very like physical experience that is missing in virtual. But at the same time, you can have these amazing deep conversations and share and expose yourself. You are missing the physical connection to another human being in that experience. So then when I say like for the older students or adults, that for me, you can kind of get further virtual with adults because you can exchange a lot like through speech and communication and ideas. And then it's always nice to be like nice to, it's nice when you finally get to meet them, if you do get the opportunity to meet them eventually, if you've met virtually first. But oftentimes I feel like, oh, I already know you really well, you know. With children, I think that with children, what was really missing was that they're not necessarily communicating always 100% verbally, like as much as, you know, I think adults have learned through experience and through their experience with language and honing their own language, they can oftentimes express, you know, a lot of what they're feeling or need to communicate through language. But with younger children, so much of that communication is happening physically or through body, and also just reassurance and comfort and help and actual physical help. Like a lot of times working with younger students, it's actually just like they just actually need physical hands-on help with things, whether it's, you know, with their own bodies or with the activity they're trying to accomplish, or yeah. And I think that for teaching younger children, you kind of just feel like that all those tools are cut off because you just can't get through the screen. So you can actually access them, but it felt a little like limited. You feel a little frustrated, like you want to jump through the screen and grab them and like, you know, help them. Whereas you don't necessarily feel that so much with adults, even though, of course, like, you know, sometimes you do want to just give somebody a hug or hand them something. But maybe the frustration level is a little lower with the adults. Is that what you were asking?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I wanted to start with making this hand gesture that I thought was really evocative, where you were holding your hands in front of you and then putting them as close to the screen and the camera as you possibly could, so that your fingertips almost like disappeared for me visually, like this like real desire to jump through the screen and how like we can be together, but we're not actually together. And that was like, that really helped me understand this, the frustration of working with young kids virtually. So I just want to make sure that the people listening can, listener can understand that.
Yes, and sometimes with children in education, I think there's also like a sensitivity when working with children. I think as learners, we all are making ourselves vulnerable, and that's the whole vulnerability and relationship is like at the heart of all teaching and learning. So this is totally true for adults and older learners, like teenage learners as well. But with younger children, and like when I say younger children, like young children and also just school age children, I think that a lot of the language of trust and vulnerability and support is physical in a way that maybe becomes less physical and more verbal, or through facial expression or whatever, as people get older. But, you know, working with young children, oftentimes when they're feeling scared or vulnerable or frustrated, just a touch on their back or just a smile, you know, just that exchange, like I said, like a physical energy, it can really kind of is what's needed in the moment. So, and a lot, you know, and with it's interesting working with children virtually, a lot of that can be done through relationship built virtually over the screen. But you, first of all, you need a lot of like, it's smaller groups, like, you know, really like more intimate virtual environments. And then also the setup. So like you can, as a teacher, you can create that relationship, but you can't control the physical on the other side of the screen where the child is actually sitting and the setup that they have. And that piece is like then dependent on who they're with physically, which is usually the parents. So I think that that's also like hard, because I think in a classroom with younger children, also a huge part of it is actually the physical setup of the classroom and how you set that learning environment and all of that. So yeah. So it was.
That makes a lot of sense. I want to go back for a second to something you said earlier, which was you said that there was a moment when things would change in education and it didn't quite go how you expected. And I'm really curious what you were expecting or hoping for, and what that moment was like for you.
Well, what I was expecting or hoping for was like, oh, finally, the whole world can see the intrinsic dysfunction and flaws of like mainstream educational approaches, where you just realize like, oh my gosh, like what? So in school age children, I think more I was thinking about like the way the majority of school age children are taught, I believe is very doesn't necessarily inspire. And I'm talking about the majority, not like, you know, I'm talking about this like conventional image of mainstream education, doesn't necessarily inspire creative thinking or it's sort of like a one size fits all kind of mentality. That's also very kind of like, usually oftentimes it's prescribed lessons and, anyways, so I was thinking like, okay, now that it's sort of, we've been all put in this position where like all systems melted down and teachers were scrambling, but the curriculum was laid bare. And like a lot of parents were seeing like, what, this is what my kid is doing, like, you know, for 7 hours a day at school. And that people would just start questioning like new and like kind of being creative and saying like, well, maybe there are other ways of teaching children that answer their needs more, or just, and also, yeah, or more contemporary and also more creative and also more holistic. And I think a lot of people felt that way. I think a lot of educators and parents felt that way during the pandemic. And a lot of parents did end up pulling their kids out of the conventional school programs and doing homeschooling or starting collectives and doing things like that. And I think that that was a response. And I guess I just thought it was going to like kind of grow and coalesce into a larger kind of educational reform movement. I thought educators would be able to like get together and, you know, lead something, and parents would be on board because they'd see the light. and so I guess that's what I was hoping. And then as a result, there'd be like similar to what happened, I think it was like about in the 70s or whatever, there was like a huge educational reform movement where suddenly they realized like, oh, rote learning isn't the way. It's when progressive education really started taking hold in public schools. And just like, you know, I thought that there would be like a new version of that kind of movement in this country, where just, yeah, creative educators would suddenly, their voices would be the ones that were being amplified and new ideas would be like listened to on a large scale. And it just didn't actually happen. And I think I was pretty disappointed. I was, at the time, I was going through a lot of like virtual conferences, like attending like virtual conferences around education, like meetings that you just like sign up for, you know, hear a speaker or like they're bringing panelists together, and all the talk was super inspired, you know, talking about new ways of learning and, you know, the changing economy. And like, you know, if the pandemic taught us anything, the world is so unpredictable. How do we prepare our children for an unpredictable future? Which is totally also the thinking I had in starting Libri School, was like we can't know what professions or, you know, what skills are necessarily going to be needed when our children become, you know, professional age. So instead of spending all of their time and our time trying to like teach them things, content that may not be relevant, like we really should focus on, you know, helping them have certain ways of thinking and analyzing and questioning and applying their skills and really teaching them how to learn, how to navigate every problematic, you know, like how to problems, like just the how to, as opposed, you know, the how to navigate, the how to acquire new skills, the how to respond, as opposed to what I see are increasingly archaic. I mean, even science is changing so quickly. You know, if you in science class, you could teach them something now and in 5 years be like, oh, oops, like we were completely wrong about that, you know? And so that's fine. But I think it's important to teach them to expect that, you know, like, I don't know, instead of spending all your energy teaching them the thing as if it's real. So there was a lot of talk during the pandemic, hopeful, inspiring talk. And I guess I just, like, at this point, I'm like, where did it all go? Like, that energy seems to have just dissipated. And people have sort of settled back and are kind of just limping along, trying to make things work. And almost like trying to make things work in a way that's like as close to what it was before the pandemic as possible, but it can't be exact. It's not the same. So it's not exactly the same, but it's just, we're like still in triage, but it's not necessarily being acknowledged. I think there's burnout, there's disillusionment, and there's just plain survival of like, in terms of like with families, students and teachers, actually, when I think about it, and administrators, like it's like everyone is just trying their best to keep this thing afloat. That's the vibe I get in schools and education now, is like we're all just trying to like do the best we can and keep it afloat. There's not like a lot of energy behind experimentation, new ideas, and really like even healing. Like, I think that's also missing, like in schools, is like, I think that everyone kind of just was like, let's get the kids back in the classrooms and the teachers back in the classrooms, and let's pick up where we left off, and do the best we can with continued limitations and restrictions. And it's better than it was when we were all locked down, not what it was before we got, you know, it hasn't come back full, but it's better than lockdown. But there's not, honestly, not that much attention paid to like the healing that's needed. And I think that's biting us in the ass. Like, I think that teachers are, for me as a parent still with kids in school, not my school now anymore, but like in a school, you know, I get the feeling that it's like everyone's kind of phoning it in, honestly, just doing, which is probably, but then everyone's just accepting that because it's probably the best they can do, you know, like, and parents, and even parents are like still scrambling, like you're not going to be really pushing for more because you're in your life, you can barely kind of, you're just trying to get your kid in school every day is like the baseline goal. Maybe it just takes time. Maybe it, like, things are still percolating, and that, you know, maybe we're still sort of very much in the pandemic, not sort of at the tail, like, and maybe it's just about more time, like getting through this. And then there'll be like a reimagining of what's possible. Yeah, I don't know if you're experiencing that, but I am.
Yeah, I definitely feel the truth of what you're just saying. And I'm wondering, I feel like you did speculate about why, just sort of the exhaustion and the burnout explanation, but I'm wondering if you have any other thoughts about why it is that the transformation or the all of the realizations and that energy hasn't moved anywhere. It could be time. I think
exhaustion and burnout has to do with it. But then I also think that we are sort of, is all tied in for me to the political moment of this country and the world, and that I feel that this country is so deeply divided. That it's just been that energy of change and like, let's do something new, is like going in two different directions, very extreme different directions. So the movement that I'm interested in just doesn't, in my mind, seem to be like gaining much traction. And then also, I do think that the burnout is like the real burnout of the job, you know, of education. But then I think there's also like an overall burnout where, you know, you're like, as an educator or as a parent or as a student, and I have a teenage daughter, so I see this in her, you know, you want to push for change, say in education, and then you look at school shootings, and then you're like, whoa, I like, actually, we have to first take on gun rights. And then suddenly Roe gets overturned, and you're like, no, we really have to take on fundamental women's rights, or, you know, bodily autonomy. Like, and then like not even the state of democracy and elections and January, like it's just, I feel that the burnout or whatever is more, it's also political, where you're just like not sure where to put your energy. It's such a time of crisis. There's like also the war in Ukraine. Like there's war, there's violence, there's so much going on that it's, I think it is also overwhelming. And and like, so it's really hard to know what to fight for, you know, inflation, the wealth disparity. And then the biggest issue, climate change, which is like, yeah, is also on all of our minds as well. So I do think that in my mind, I speculate that that's part of it too. And that's how I feel in my life as well, is like, sometimes it feels a little like, I don't know what issue or change to push for right now, because there's so much that I feel passionately about that is like hurting me and hurting, you know, is not the world, is moving away from the world that I want to live in, or I want my children to live in. And it's really confusing and hard to know where to put your energy. And I mean, I do believe education is the place to put your energy, because I think it's like a positive force and it changes people's way of thinking and all of that. But sometimes it feels a little like less pressing than hunger or death, you know. so it can be, it maybe that's it too. Maybe it's just like not a time right now. It's almost like maybe we have to put out some other fires in this country and then create space to rebuild something that's like positive. I don't know. That's one speculation. I think also the other one is that the unacknowledged grief, the unacknowledged pain, like the healing aspect. I think as educators and like as students, we've like rushed everyone back in. I mean, like I said, like I have a daughter who is 14, and I just, you know, now it's summer and I look back on her school year and she's telling me things that she was going through in the school year that I had no idea she was experiencing just internally. And I realized like, wow, I really was thinking like, so kind of convinced that her being back in physical school was like such a positive thing, that I wasn't realizing like everything else that was happening inside underneath the surface. And I'm sure it's happening for every student in the classroom and every teacher in the classroom. And it's not really being talked about. It's not really being kind of addressed head on and in a healing kind of, let's like go through this together and let's like make this a priority before we get to the content and the getting you through grade eight or whatever. So I think that the fact that that piece is missing doesn't really, then no one can kind of really move forward. You know, we're just kind of going along, right? We're not actually moving forward intentionally in a new way. So yeah, I wish there was more. I wish schools and administrators had put more attention to like, not just getting people back into the classroom, but being like, okay, now we're back after this major trauma. Let's talk about that trauma. And then, yeah, I don't know.
And as you said, with young kids, I mean, I'm wanting to connect this back to what you were saying about the challenge of being virtual with kids, which is that care and trust comes in with the body.
Yeah.
And so how even like, what are even the tools for grief tending with kids where you can't just sit around and have a circle and talk about it?
Mm-hmm.
That I'm hearing that conversation that we had earlier about virtual in the context of the grief and feeling that those two things are really related.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they are really related. And I think that it's also really hard because even at the beginning of this school year, you know, or I mean, throughout the whole school year, again, we're back in the classroom, but kids aren't necessarily encouraged to touch and we're all wearing masks. And that's, and I'm like a huge supporter of public health. And so I'm like, you know, I err on the side of wearing, keeping masks on longer. But it's a reality that the fact that you're all wearing masks and you're not encouraged to touch each other, even though you're back in school, is like another layer of dissociation and possible, you know, trauma. And that, yeah. And I think that it's not that people aren't aware of it. It's just, I'm not seeing it. I mean, of course, individual educator by individual educator, where they're creating their own environment. So there's sure there's teachers out there who are actually acknowledging it and making it really something that can be processed. But in a lot of classrooms I've been seeing, it's really kind of just more like unspoken. Yeah.
So
yeah, we have a lot we have a lot to work through as a country. So
that litany, you know, of all the griefs.
It's like, yeah.
So it's 12:45. And so I said that this would be the time when we would switch gears. I wanted to start by asking, you know, we're putting together what you're a part of this document or this collection of voices of educators in this time. And so I'm wondering sort of what you think we have here or what you hope will come from the future life of this project now that it's exiting the interviewing phase and moving forward into the sort of chorus of voices phase. Mm-hmm.
I guess what one thing I want to acknowledge is that through the pandemic, this project has been a real source of hope and connection, especially at the times when we were all locked up and we couldn't have connections. It has always been a space where I could share these ideas and hope around education in a way that was very uplifting. And I actually, you know, ended up meeting people through this project that I ended up working with, like on their curriculums and making deep connections and supporting each other. So I just want to say that I've been very grateful for this project. And I guess my hope for this project would be just that it is a chorus of voices of educators in different circumstances that that will live in a way that can inspire and inform like that the future of education, which I hope is moving towards, you know, a revolution or a radical change. And then maybe it is going in that direction, just the pace might be just sort of the pace that it needs to be right now, as opposed to some kind of, you know, radical upheaval of everything we've known before into new ways. I think maybe it's more about kind of moving forward and going at the pace that it needs to go. So I just hope that this archive serves as a resource and a reminder that's like what educators were going through, thinking about, and that as we move forward, that we can continue to push education forward and question what's not working and fight for what we believe does work for learners.
Yeah. Is there anything that you want to put on the record, either about your experience or about the project or about the COVID years, the ongoing COVID years, that we haven't had the chance to talk about or that you haven't had the chance to talk about in your previous interviews?
I I don't know. There's nothing that really that comes to mind. I guess mainly kind of what we were talking about just prior to switching gears, which is that I just do want to put on the record that that COVID was like a huge shock to education and also to the children that were in school. And I think that it was a shock for everything. It was obviously a shock for the world, for business, for every industry. Nobody was untouched. But I think particularly for school children, I can't remember in history when school has just been shut off to practically the whole world so suddenly and for such a prolonged period of time. And I do think that that is that was a huge disruptor that really, I think we still as adults aren't completely sure how it impacted the children that are now back in classrooms. And that I guess I'd want to put it on the record that we should look at that and we should always be questioning that and ask. And I think that I also want to put on the record that the people who are going to tell us and the people who know are the children themselves. And even my own children, you know, it's not because we're all kind of in the same boat where we're just all trying to get out the door in the mornings again and trying to get the kids in school and keep them well enough so that they can go be in school, that there's not a lot of space given to hear the children reflect on what these last 2 years have been for them. But when that space does become available, what comes out is often very surprising and much deeper and more traumatic than I would even expect. And that, I guess it just, that's what I want to put on the record is like, let's listen, let's actually pay attention to that. Let's make that a priority and make that space for the kids, and they will help us understand how to move forward. And because it is, I guess that's what it is. It's like, we talk about, you read articles, oh, the mental health of the teenagers, this and this, and you read all the articles, you know it, but I don't think that healing space, that looking to the children and trusting the children to tell us, like, this is what I need, this is what hurt me, this is what I need to move forward, it's not being prioritized as it should be. That we don't know the answers, that they know, that they don't necessarily know the answers, but if we listen, they will inform, you know, how to make the best decisions. So I think, guess that's what it is for me. Yeah.
Do you have time for one more question or do you need to go now?
I have time for one more question. Yeah.
Okay. I would love to hear where you hope that you're going in the future.
Oh yeah. I think that where I hope to be going is to continue to work in education. I'd like to start again finding opportunities to work with younger children. And I would also like to, for me, get back to writing. And whether that means writing, I write fiction, and whether that means writing fiction or writing about my experience as an educator, I hope personally that I can move forward and sort of have a voice through writing. And continue to work in education. People ask me if I'm going to start a school again, and I don't really see that in my immediate future. But I will help anybody who wants to start a school. So.
What would you say to someone who wants to start a school now?
I'd say do it. It's like needed. It's really needed. And I would say that I would help them in all ways that I do that. I actually do consult and help with that. But I would also say that it definitely takes, I would say, you know, put together I think the leadership needs to be, I think there needs to be more than one leader. I think that that was hard for on me, was running the Libri School where I didn't have a, you know, I was the director, founder, and principal. You know, it was a lot. So I would say I would encourage them to have, but oftentimes collectives and boards don't work so well because, it's a balance. It's a balance, but I don't know what I'd say. I just say do it. I'd say that education needs alternative voices and visions, and that, you know, not one school can do it all. So it's great to have options and alternatives,
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk with you, and to, you know, I feel like you helped my understanding of what's been going on, even in, you know, you helped my understanding very much. And so I just want to say thank you again for being a part of this project. I will, you know, we'll share with you all of the ways that you can continue to be involved and a part of it as time goes by. And I'm also looking forward to seeing where it goes as well, and how it takes on a new life in this new form. So
yes, I'm excited too. Thank you so much.
It's
really valuable to be part of this. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, have a good rest of your day. And I will share, I'll share the interview with you, of course. And I'm going to stop the recording and say one final goodbye to you outside of the recording, because that's something I miss about in-person interviewing, is getting a real goodbye.
Okay.